This episode is sponsored by Celestron, manufacturer of high-quality telescopes and an industry leader in developing exciting optical products with revolutionary technologies.
I'm Kelly Beattie of Sky and Telescope magazine, and tonight we're going on a tour of the stars and planets that you'll see overhead during January. First, we'll watch one of the year's best meteor showers, then check out a planetary traffic jam, size up a celestial queen with an ego problem, and learn about a celestial hunter who also has an ego problem. So grab your curiosity and come along on this month's Sky Tour. Well, 2021 is behind us, and 2022 has begun. Every January, millions of us resolve to do something, anything, different or better in the coming year. I suppose my resolution would be to get outside and enjoy the night sky more. It'll be tough. Often I'm too busy or too tired or, well, you get the picture. So how's about you and I agree to do more stargazing this coming year, okay? We'll want to make good on that pledge right away because a most excellent opportunity occurs in the first week of January with the arrival of the quadranted meteor shower. These shooting stars get their name from Quadrans Mirales, an obsolete constellation near the handle of the Big Dipper, and they seem to radiate from that point in the sky. The source of this shower is an object designated 2003 EH1, which loops around the Sun every 5.5 years between the orbits of Earth and Jupiter. It's not an active comet like the ones that create other meteor showers. More likely, it's an extinct comet, one that no longer has any ice. The quads can deliver at least one meteor per minute under excellent, perfectly dark skies. In fact, in some years, observers have reported seeing twice as many. But few of us ever see anything close to that, for a couple of reasons. First, the shower's maximum activity lasts only several hours, and it's easy to miss. Seeing 25 per hour is more typical. Second, for most of us, that radiant point near the Big Dipper is below the northern horizon until 1 or 2 a.m., and no radiant means no meteors. This year, the peak occurs around 4 p.m. Eastern Time on January 3rd. That's well-timed for Europe, but poor for North America. Those on the East Coast can flip a coin and watch before dawn on either January 3rd or the 4th. Those of you farther west get a very slight advantage by going out the earlier morning, January 3rd. Fortunately, the moon is new, so its light won't be any problem. So bundle up and go view those quads. A second celestial event occurs in the first week of the new year, though this one is far more subtle. On January 4th, at 2 a.m. Eastern Time, Earth is 91,400,000 miles away from the Sun. That's closer to our star than it'll be at any time for the rest of the year. Can't you just feel all that extra warmth? Now, I don't expect many of you to be up that early, so let's focus on a planetary pileup that's low in the west right after sundown. For months now, we've been watching Jupiter, Saturn, and Venus parading across the evening sky. But the party's just about over. For example, Venus has been sinking fast after sunset, and it's basically a lost cause unless you look really close to the western horizon right after sundown, early in the month. By January 5th or 6th, it's a goner. Then, late this month, you can start watching for Venus as it reappears before dawn, low in the east. Meanwhile, Mercury has been moving up to take the place of much brighter Venus. Look for Mercury, low in the west, about 30 minutes after sundown. It'll be most obvious around January 7th. And in the days afterward, it'll edge closer and closer to Saturn, which is also saying goodbye to its evening appearance. The two planets are closest, about 3 degrees apart, on January 12th. Watching over all of this is Jupiter, which is to the upper left of the sunset point by 3 or 4 times the width of your clenched fist held at arm's length. Jupiter's days are numbered too. It'll sink out of view by late February, so enjoy it while you can. Now let's talk stars for a bit. What's your favorite star pattern? It doesn't have to be an entire constellation. It might be any obvious arrangement of bright stars, what astronomers call an asterism. Maybe it's the Big Dipper, but right now that's lying low along or even below the northern horizon, depending on your latitude. Another obvious asterism is the five-star zigzag of Cassiopeia. It looks like a squashed W in the summertime and like a flattened M in winter. After sunset, once it gets dark, face north and look almost straight up. There's Cassiopeia in its M position. It's a little wider than your clenched fist at arm's length. Its left side is brightest and easiest to see. This pattern of stars is the Big Dipper's counterpart in the northern sky. In spring and summer, when the Dipper rides high, Cassiopeia lurks low. In fall and winter, it's Cassiopeia's turn to shine high over the evening world, while the Dipper sinks low behind the trees. All five stars in this M asterism are truly big and bright, outshining the sun by anywhere from 70 to 8,000 times. This impressive brightness, combined with being no more than a few hundred light years away, is why you can spot this distinctive quintet almost at a glance from your driveway. In Greek mythology, Cassiopeia was a queen in what's now Ethiopia and the mother of Andromeda. This mythical queen boasted that she and her daughter were more beautiful than all the Nereids, the nymphy daughters of the sea god Nereus. This was not a good idea. All that bragging brought the wrath of Poseidon upon the kingdom of Ethiopia. But that's a complicated story for another time. Ancient sky watchers not only subdivided the sky into constellations, but also gave each noteworthy star its own proper name. Some of these came from various cultures and flukes of folklore, but often they simply told the body part that the star supposedly represents in its constellation figure. For example, although the middle star in Cassiopeia's M has no official name, the ones on either side of it, plus the bright one at the left end, are named Kaf, Shedar, and Rukbe. These are medieval European corruptions of the Arabic words for hand, breast, and knee. Let's leave the queen and shift our gaze about four fists toward east. That bright star almost overhead is named Capella. It's at the top left corner of an irregular pentagon of stars that outlines the constellation Auriga, though I think Auriga is closer to its Latin root. This translates as the charioteer, one of 48 constellations recognized in ancient Roman times. However, this star pattern was recorded long before that by sky watchers in Mesopotamia, who noted a constellation called Gam that represented a curved sword or crook. You can make out that arc using Capella as one end and then curving down and toward the right. Auriga has also been seen as a goat herder, first by long-ago Bedouins and later in Greek mythology. In fact, Capella takes its name from the Latin word for a small female goat, and just to its right is the faint triangle of stars called the Kids, as in little goats. To this day, the constellation Auriga has something of a split personality. Artists often depict it as a charioteer with a goat perched on his shoulders. But in ancient Hindu astronomy, Capella was important because it represented the heart of Brahma, the god of creation. About four fists to the lower left of Capella, you'll see the stars of Orion, the hunter, striding up from the horizon early on January evenings. In Greek mythology, Orion was a gigantic, supernaturally strong hunter who also thought very highly of himself, and he had a lecherous eye for the ladies. Anyway, look in particular for a trio of bright stars in a vertical row. These mark Orion's belt, yet another asterism, and there's nothing else like them anywhere in the sky. To the belt's upper left is the bright star Betelgeuse, which marks the hunter's shoulder. Maybe you've heard it called Betelgeuse, like that weird 1988 movie? Use whatever works for you. Study Betelgeuse a bit, and maybe you'll notice that it's got a warm color, like weak ginger ale. That's because this is a red supergiant, a truly massive star that has swollen to tremendous size in its old age. But Betelgeuse still looks like a pinpoint in the sky because it's very far away, about 600 light-years. This reddish star with the funny name was acting funny a couple of years ago. Betelgeuse had been getting fainter and fainter, eventually becoming dimmer than at any time since astronomers began measuring its brightness almost a century ago. At first they didn't know why this was happening or when the dimming would stop. But now they think that this star, already known to be an enormous, churning cauldron of superheated gas, probably belched out a large cloud of dark dust that made it appear dimmer for a time. Apparently Betelgeuse itself was fine, though it got a little cranky. On the right side of Orion's belt is another really bright star, Rigel. Can you see the color difference between peachy Betelgeuse and icy white Rigel? It might seem counterintuitive, but these icy white stars are the very hottest. Rigel's surface temperature is more than 20,000 degrees Fahrenheit, whereas Betelgeuse is only a third of that. Go figure. That's about it for this month. If you want more tips for viewing the night sky, including a free interactive star chart for any time or date, check out our website, skyandtelescope.org. If you haven't already subscribed, you can find this Sky Tour on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. And please do leave a rating or review. It will help others find the show. And if you want to explore the solar system and universe more deeply, please do check out the full line of binoculars and telescopes available at Celestron.com. Sky Tour is a production of Sky and Telescope, a division of the American Astronomical Society, and is produced by me, Kelly Beatty. Next month, we'll spend a little time with the part of the Milky Way you can see in winter rather than in summer. Until then, I wish you clear skies.